From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The Synod of Bishops in Rome on Youth, Faith, and Discernment of Vocations has just completed its second week and its third week as Catholics await the publication of its final report in what will be its final week. We get a full update of what is happening in the Vatican, and the midterms are only weeks away, and control of Congress is hanging in the balance. This week on Register Radio, we talk to EWTN contributor Father Thomas Petrie on what's happening in Rome right now. And then we're joined by Register correspondent Stephen Beal on the political situation in a divided America. I'm Matthew Bunsen, the Register senior editor and co-host for Register Radio, filling in this week as host for Jeanette DeMello, who's off. Jeanette, of course, is our beloved editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register. Well, as the Synod of Bishops on Youth enters its final week, speculation continues as to what will be in the final report and how it will deal with the controversial issues facing the Church. To talk about that, as well as just the fun of both of us being in studio here in Rome to cover the Synod, I'm joined by Father Thomas Petrie. He is Dean of the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C., and I am privileged to say two other things about him. The first is that he has been filling in as a co-host of our EWTN News Presents, our coverage of the Synod here from Rome on television. Father, welcome.
Thank you.
And probably the most important thing to say about you is that I consider you one of my great friends.
Oh, I'm really honored to be that we're friends, Matthew, and it's great to be here in Rome with you and Brian Patrick, our other co-host and friend on the TV news coverage.
Well, we can also give a very brief plug to the fact that we have a new radio show coming up right after the start of the year.
The Church Alive. Look for it on EWTN Radio starting Saturdays in the new year. We're really excited about that. I can't wait to get that started.
I have been following you on Twitter for a long time, so I appreciate the fact that you've been tweeting that out. You have, I think, officially now more Twitter followers than anyone else in the, I'm guessing, history of the Dominican Order?
Probably the history of the Dominican Order. His Eminence Cardinal Schönborn is a Dominican, and then so for a while I was playing catch-up to him, but we just sort of passed him in the last month or so. So it's we have a little friendly rivalry with some of the friars on Twitter, but I'm so far leading that race.
Not to wander too far afield, but were Thomas Aquinas to be around today, do you think he'd take to Twitter?
I don't know. I think he would in a certain way, in a very charitable way. You read some of his replies to the objections of his answers in the Summa, and some of them are quite terse and have a little bit of humor. He sort of is able to slay the objector pretty charitably, but convincingly.
So let's just say that his replies are tweetable.
His replies are tweetable, right. And I have tweeted some of
you
his
have
replies.
Tweeted. I've seen them actually. So we're both here for the Synod of Bishops, and this has been something of a controversial subject for quite some time, almost from the day that this Synod was announced. It's a great concern as to what exactly was going to happen here in Rome, and also how that final report's going, not just what it's going to read like, but how the process is going to unfold in its creation. You've been here now for a couple of days. I know you've been following the Synod very closely for quite some time. Let's give us a quick snapshot on where we are as we move into this last week and your overall impression of how things are going.
Well, I think everyone remembers the Synods of 2014 and the Synods of 2015, and when the question of communion to the divorced and civilly remarried seemed to dominate, and there seemed to be coordinated groups of various bishops and synod fathers and synod groups in different parts of, especially the developed world, pushing a change or in church, I would say a change in church doctrine, they would argue it's just a change in practice. I don't see a difference between the two. I don't get the sense that the same thing is going on here at this synod. I think partly because saying a synod on youth, it's such a broad topic. I mean, and it's hard to have an idea of exactly what we're talking about when we talk about youth. And if you read the interventions and even the summaries of the small language groups, they're really all over the board. You know, what we're finding is that the only united group seems to be the African bishops and some of the Asian bishops, perhaps, who really are pushing for stronger, challenging gospel truths, and in fact, how do we reach the youth in those ways? So I'm cautiously optimistic about what the document will say. I think people are concerned that it might be too centrally organized and that it might be too managed in a certain way from those who usually run these synods. But it sounds from what we've heard here and what we've been seeing in some of the reports is that there is an open and free discussion going on in the Synod Hall.
But an open and free discussion that, based on a lot of the people you and I have talked to, is centered around what we would like to see it centered around.
Yes, exactly. Just once again, it's such a broad field, but it seems to be on how can we reach the youth? What are the problems that the youth of the world who are Catholic are encountering, and even those who have fallen away from the church? You know, you and I spoke a little bit last night on the television show about the nones, the ones who don't identify with any particular religion. How do we reach them? Of course, this is a huge problem in the United States, but it's also a problem elsewhere in the world. It's not just the United States that has this problem.
And talking about what could be in that report, one of the little ways that we have of guessing what will be in there are the so-called trucoli minori, to use the phrase that they do here, basically the small language groups.
Right.
And there have been reports published every week since the start of the Synod, gathering up the information, and then it's summarized and sent out for those who may not be familiar with the process or the synodal process. I know you've had a chance to read those small reports, those different language groups from around the world. What were some of your sort of takeaways from that?
Well, as I said earlier, I think it's a lot of the languages, clearly a few of them you can see as the reports keep coming out. There is maybe a language group or two where there does seem to be consistent agendaed issues. This is where
Derwin used the term the German.
The German group, yes, okay. And certainly one of the English-speaking groups. You know, we do see a consistent concern about ministering to what they colloquially refer to as different types of families, you know, by which obviously we take to mean LGBT families. But many of them are also varied in what they're talking about, whether it's youth involved in gangs, whether it's talking about how youth are affected by immigration. Some of them are concerned on how the youth in developing countries in the world are exploited by trafficking and exploited by economic pressures. And so it's such a broad topic to talk about youth in general. I have no idea how they're going to be able to reconcile all of these groups and bring them together into one document.
For those who follow synods, and I've had the, I guess the sad statement about my life that I have covered these for many years, this is a pretty chronic problem, though, in synods, that we have this almost a titanic amount of information.
That's right.
And all sorts of different propositions and ideas that are put forward and then have to be distilled down into a document.
Well, and people are concerned. I know we've read a lot of concern in social media and some of the Catholic media that perhaps the final document was pre-written and, you know, this is just a sort of pro forma. It's for show that we're having these conversations in the Synod Hall. But to be quite honest, this is often the case, right?
Historically,
it's the case that there is a draft written based on the Instrumentum Laboris, which is the released document before the Synod begins.
The blueprint for the Synod. Now, in fairness, the Instrumentum Laboris for this Synod has been repeatedly and very roundly criticized.
Exactly. And so if there was a draft based on it, it necessarily is going to be changed and modified. But even the synods under, you know, John Paul II had a sort of pre-draft ready because they sort of knew what was probably going to be talked about based on the Instrumentum Laboris. The problem is, as you say, the current Instrumentum Laboris for this synod has been roundly criticized, and there's been a lot of issues with it that the bishops have raised. So we expect that the final draft will not reflect entirely what this Instrumentum Laboris did. One of the issues was, for instance, the Instrumentum uses the phraseology LGBT, and the only interventions that we've heard that have come from the floor have been to criticize the use of that language.
Now, not to get too far again into the process question, but that's an important element here. The question was raised at a number of the press conferences here with the Sala Stampa, the Holy See Press Office, as to what the final vote process is going to be. And there seemed to be a real effort to stress that the process is essentially unchanged, that each of the paragraphs, and I noticed that there was a lot of quibbling over what they even mean by paragraph,
right.
Number, part. But all of this, everything in that document has to be voted on and receive a two-thirds majority.
Yes, before it can go forward. Now, of course, the Holy Father can put whatever he wants to in the final document. That's we are a church that follows the Pope. We are not conciliarists. We don't follow councils per se. We follow what the Pope's interpretive.
And even less so synods.
And even less so synods. But that's right. It's going to be like every other synod since the Second Vatican Council, which they're going to vote on every number, every paragraph, whatever you want to call it. Paragraph by paragraph. Now, the difficulty, obviously, is that the draft will end up being in Italian, and not all the Synod Fathers speak Italian or read Italian, so they're going to read through it. I understand they're going to read through it in the hall with simultaneous translations in their ear, and then they're going to go back through it to vote on each paragraph and whether it gets an up and down two-thirds vote. So that means those bishops who and those delegates who do not have Italian, a command of Italian, they're going to have to take detailed notes on, yes, I'm not going to vote for this paragraph, I will vote for that paragraph as they're reading through it.
And I would imagine that any bishop who's in there has his own priorities.
Absolutely.
And so certain sections are going to be of greater interest to him than other parts.
That's right. And depending on how long it is, I can't imagine having a, 40-page document read to me in a language I don't understand with a simultaneous translation in my ear. I mean, that is a penance in itself, so I'm going to pray for all of them.
I have to wonder if you're being somewhat optimistic that this thing's only going to be 40 pages.
I might be optimistic on this point.
The Instrumentum Laboris, I think, was a rather hefty document.
It was. No, that's true. So that was probably about, 40 or 50 full length, 8.5 by 11 pages, so this will be longer.
Very briefly, we've covered issues such as the digital world, the problems there of evangelization, of fragmentation. We haven't had that much discussion of things like discernment and conscience and the formation of conscience, but there does seem to be this real desire on the part of the Synod Fathers, to use the traditional term, of fostering that encounter with Jesus Christ.
And that's what all Christian life ought to be for all of us, is encountering Jesus Christ, and once we encounter him, following his will wherever it may lead. And that's traditionally what discernment ought to be. Unfortunately, when we talk about discernment these days, it's becoming quite confused with a sort of theory of the primacy of conscience. But we always have to remember, our conscience isn't the final authority. The truth of the gospel is always the final authority.
Well, let's leave that there. Father Thomas Petrie, Dean of the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C., I want to thank you especially for your great work in providing us with commentary and analysis on our coverage of the Synod this last week. It was a great joy to have you, and I look forward also to our radio show.
Thank you so much, Matthew. I'm looking forward to the new year. It's going to be great.
When we come back, I'm going to talk with Register correspondent Stephen Beal about the upcoming midterm elections in the United States. A lot is hanging in the balance, including the future of the Trump administration. This is Register Radio on EWTN. Don't go anywhere.
Have you heard who's reading the Register? Why, it's Tim Staples.
The National Catholic Register gives you the world's news like no other. Only NCR has a stable of writers steeped in good Catholic theology and philosophy to give you the news with proper perspective.
For a 3-month free subscription to the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 3 months free banner, or call 1-800-421-3230.
Father Benedict Groeschel.
No Catholic can support abortion, and that Catholics are responsible to take serious action against legalized abortion.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Matthew Bunsen, senior editor with the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio, filling in for Jeanette DeMello, our editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register this week. Well, as anyone who follows politics is aware, the midterm elections are only a few weeks away. And there has been not just a divided political landscape, but a bitterly divided political landscape, especially in the aftermath of the nomination process of now Justice Brett Kavanaugh. To talk about these midterm elections, we're joined by Stephen Beal, a Register correspondent who's been doing quite a bit of reporting on the midterm elections. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, last month you reported on the possibility, even the likelihood, of the Democrats taking over at least the House of Representatives. Now, the Senate, I know, is still something in play. That was before Judge Kavanaugh's hearings. What are the polls saying now, or what at least is your sense of where this situation is in terms of the elections?
I think it's still very divided. I think the mainstream media narrative is that suburban women who are leaning Democrat are going to be energized. They're going to come out. There's going to be this blue wave. The Democrats will take back the House. There'll be some surprise Senate wins. But the Republican base is very energized as well by the Kavanaugh hearings. They think Democrats went too far, that they tarnished Brett Kavanaugh's reputation unfairly. And they're very motivated to come out. They're very happy with Kavanaugh's nomination. They're very happy that we now have two more pro-life justices on the Supreme Court. And so in many ways, they're just as energized as the Democratic base. And a lot of the polls show things being very close in terms of how Kavanaugh's nomination is affecting the vote.
Yeah, the Kavanaugh hearing seemed one of those moments that crystallized this campaign for a lot of people. And there seemed to be a very significant shift during the hearings, especially the most controversial parts of them. Is it safe to say that everyone now is aware of the Kavanaugh hearings, and everyone now seems to have an opinion or at least some idea of how they're going to vote?
I think so. I mean, I think Kavanaugh's hearings, the significance went way far beyond just a single seat on the Supreme Court. I think for a lot of Democrats, they saw in Kavanaugh the things that they don't like about Donald Trump. And I think for Republicans, they saw the things that they do like about Donald Trump, especially more of the Christian conservative base of the Republican Party. They saw a president who is delivering on his promises to appoint pro-life justices. And especially for, I think, Catholics, they saw somebody who is a faithful Catholic. He talked about during the hearing that his daughter had prayed for the woman who accused him of assaulting her. So I think, absolutely, I think it's just hardened both sides.
In much the same way that the hearings themselves seem to divide almost perfectly politically, with a few exceptions, where do you think at this point the Latino vote, which is obviously so crucial to the Democrats building that traditional coalition for winning in campaigns, where is that? Because we keep hearing different stories and reports that the Latino vote is not necessarily as galvanized for the Democrats this year as one would expect.
Well, I think the Latino vote isn't monolithic. I think you had a lot of Cubans in Miami who were enthusiastic Republicans and supported Donald Trump. I think the Latino vote is very conflicted right now with what has been going on in immigration and very lukewarm, I think, towards Republicans because of that. Maybe more so now than they were 2 years ago. So I think it's really harder to forecast where the Latino vote would go in the midterms.
And in many of these congressional districts, just a margin of a few percentage points in either direction could make this a swing seat or a hold seat, depending upon the party.
For sure. And in the article, I do talk about some of the races that are very close to watch. Especially in Pennsylvania, you've got some races where you have two, both challengers, I believe, are Catholics. One's pro-life, one's pro-choice, and I go into that a little bit in my article. So especially in the state of Pennsylvania, there's some bellwether House races you'd want to watch to go either way.
Well, shifting over to the Senate briefly, obviously there was intense pressure on a lot of the blue state Republicans, but also, in particular, the red state Democrats. I'm thinking of Joe Manchin, Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Donnelly, all of them facing very stiff reelections. And of that group, Joe Manchin actually voted for the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh. What's your sense at this point of where this map looks for the U.S. Senate, especially for the Democrats, who I think are at a pretty severe disadvantage, just at least in terms of the number of incumbents and the number of incumbents in red states?
I think the Democrats still have an uphill battle to regain the Senate. I do think the Kavanaugh hearings have energized a lot of those maybe Reagan Democrats, if you will, who would be more likely to vote for Donald Trump. So I think they still have an uphill battle. I think some Republicans, though, are in trouble as well. I think Susan Collins is facing a backlash for her vote for Kavanaugh. Ted Cruz is still in big trouble in Texas with Beto O'Rourke, is challenging him. The race is much closer than anyone expected it to be. So I think the Senate is still in play. The Republicans are still much more favored to hold on to it, but I think Democrats are still have a good chance of seizing it as well.
Mm-hmm. Is there any backlash that you know of in Texas that so much outside money has just poured into Beto O'Rourke's campaign? I've forgotten what his war chest is, but I think, close to $40 million or something like that?
It is extremely large. I think Ted Cruz, it may be the weakness of Ted Cruz as well.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a very likable person. I think nationally, just a lot of people like the opportunity of taking him out. He's a very prominent Republican, obviously was one of the candidates for the Republican nomination. So I think he's just got a target on his back because he's so well known. And
right,
so unlikable as well.
Well, certainly being chased out of D.C. restaurants may have made him a slightly more sympathetic figure, at least to some of the Texas voters. As somebody who lives in Washington, D.C., this is becoming an alarmingly common occurrence. But that point you raise about vulnerable Republicans in this Senate cycle, what are the odds, you think, of a major Republican going down, someone like Cruz? I mean, I know that it's a tight race with Beto O'Rourke, but what would be the implications, for example, of a major loss for the Republicans, even if they do manage to hang on to the Senate?
A major loss in Texas, I mean, I think it would say a few different things. First of all, red and blue states are not solidly red, solidly blue, and we forget that so easily. Massachusetts has lots of Republicans. Rhode Island is one of, where my home state is one of the bluest states. We have whole towns that went from Donald Trump. So these states are not homogenous. They're much more diverse than we realize. So I think, you know, it's the first thing to keep in mind. Secondly, it's the impact of the Hispanic population. Texas has a lot of Hispanic voters. And a lot of Hispanics are moving not just into states like Texas, but other southern states, and that's going to change the demographics of these states. And thirdly, it could signal some kind of Democratic resurgence. Absolutely. There's no other way to read that kind of an outcome other than signaling just how much trouble Republicans will be in. So, you know, those would be, I think, some of the ways to look at that.
You know, you've written about some of the key issues that are emerging. There's obviously abortion and immigration. What's going on those two fronts?
Well, in terms of the federal congressional elections, if the Democrats take back the House, pro-life legislation grinds to a halt, and there are a number of important bills. Pro-lifers have been pushing through 20-week abortion ban, bills like that. If the Democrats take the Senate, it means that any future Supreme Court vacancies will be difficult to fill with a conservative pro-lifer. Also, any appointments to Trump's administration could be stonewalled by Democrats in the Senate. So not just Supreme Court nominees, but Health and Human Services, other posts where pro-life policies could be implemented, those could be held up as well. And then, of course, I also talk about the state elections. Because remember, we're not just voting for people in the House, the Senate, we're voting for people, the state
right.
Legislatures, we're voting for governors, attorney generals. So we have to remember that if the Supreme Court does take action on Roe v. Wade, that returns the issue to the state legislatures. So the state legislatures become extremely important for the issue of abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just one example of many, but a number of issues of religious liberty. Main battleground for religious liberty has been at the states over the past 10 years. So the states are incredibly important as well, and I believe my article on that just is up on the site on Thursday. So,
yeah, and governorships, too, have to factor rather large in this. The Republicans have owned for a while now a pretty sizable majority of the state governor's mansions, but that could be changing, couldn't it?
That could as well. There are about, I believe, 36 governor positions that are open. One state where Republicans are at risk of losing is Illinois. There's a venture capitalist and the heir to one of the hotel fortunes is running as a Democrat. He's obviously got deep pockets and extremely pro-choice. He's donated to the Planned Parenthood PAC, which is in turn spending money to defeat prominent pro-life Republicans. A lot of these governor's seats are vital. We also have a talk in my article about a number of very good pro-life governors who are running, for example, Kay Ivey in Alabama, Kim Reynolds in Iowa. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the governor races, absolutely abortion is an issue as well. And it's obviously governors who are going to be, you need a pro-life governor to sign that legislation that those state assemblies are passing.
Yeah, you really do. Important. So not to put you on the spot, but in just the second or two that we have left, your predictions, will the Republicans lose the House or Senate?
Oh, boy.
We won't hold you to it.
I think it's likely that the Democrats will take the House. I think there's just too much in their favor right now. I see is still going Republican. But the House is very likely to go Democrat. I mean, it's just the way these things go often. The nation votes against the incumbent president. It's just been the pattern for the past.
Well, I'll take your wager, and we won't play this back to you at a future date if you're wrong. Well, Stephen, thanks so much. And people can find you reporting at ncregister.com. Thank you so much for tuning in to Register Radio this week. I would encourage you also to tune in to EWTN's ongoing coverage of the Synod of Bishops from Rome. I'll be reporting every day from the Eternal City in different platforms, but in particular on our nightly show, which airs at 5 p.m. Eastern and 11 p.m. Eastern, with me, Brian Patrick, and Father Raymond D'Souza. Well, remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks so much for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Jeanette DeMello and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Until next week, take care and God bless.